Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week I'm joined by a veritable monsoon of guests and regulars. Joining me in the pod are Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, who will be joining us later on in the program. Jemima's here already.
Hiya.
Hi, Jemima. Plus special guest Mike Butcher on loan for the day from TechCrunch, where he's the editor of UK and Europe.
Hello, fans.
So smooth.
Hello, London. Brilliant. So what have you all been doing this week, Jemima?
I'm trying to sync my bloody iPhone. It just will not sync with iTunes. I think it's because I've got 3,500 contacts in it. It just sort of creaks.
Wow. Only 3,500?
Yeah, no.
That would be a very valuable resource if it happened to find its way.
Oh, if somebody stole it. Oh, no,
I wouldn't
what have I put out there?
Mike, what have you been up to this week?
Recovering from Mobile World Congress in Barcelona and thanking the gods above for bringing my laptop safely back after about 2,000 were stolen.
Oh,
2,000 laptops were stolen.
Oh, well, maybe I'm exaggerating, but just everybody I know pretty much had something stolen.
We won't go into that. On this week's show, interestingly enough, we're scraping back the data privacy blanket. So who knows what was on your laptop? Peering under the digital bedsheets to peek at the data collected about you and what it can offer both developers and other people in the real world. We'll be joined by Tom Elube from Garlic and Noshir Contractor from Northwestern University. I told you it was a packed pod. And we're going to be hacking out the issues in this timely debate. We're also taking a gander at the final news headlines from the Mobile World Congress that took place in Barcelona last week. Mike will be leading us through the trends, the apps, and the British startups that made their debuts in between the bottles of Rioja. Keep listening for 30 minutes of technological treasure. Last week, word got out that the veritable motherload of data uploaded onto Facebook by the millions of users around the world, from the inane status updates to the gigabytes of humiliating photographs, was to be sold to marketers for their own nefarious deeds. Almost instantly, the backlash descended and the social network reversed its position. Meanwhile, at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a consortium of respected academics reported their initial findings from the 60 terabytes of behavioral data they have scraped from the servers of the Sony online game EverQuest 2. And just a few days ago, CBS was accused of colluding with music rights organizations by delivering data on users' music listening practices so the boards could point the finger at copyright breachers. Now, this has since, of course, been disproved. However, privacy is a hot topic. Joining us to discuss these issues are Professor Noshir Contractor from Northwestern University, one of the academics involved in the EverQuest 2 research, and Tom Elube from Garlic, a service that lets people take control of their online data trails. Professor Contractor, can you tell us what it is that you aim to gain by accessing and analyzing this vast quantity of data from the game?
The main focus of our project is to gain a better understanding of the factors, that the social drivers, if you may, that drive the emergence of networks in offline and online worlds. So for a variety of reasons, the social sciences has only been able to succeed in a limited fashion in understanding what motivates us to create our links. We now have the ability to interact with anyone, anytime, any place, and yet we choose to interact with some people and not with others. Understanding what motivates us to choose the people we want to interact with is a profoundly important question and of increasing salience. The EverQuest dataset gives us unprecedented access to all the actions, all the interactions, and all the transactions that individuals are involved in within this particular massively multiplayer online game. I must hasten to add that the access that we have here to actions, interactions, and transactions is all anonymized, so we don't have any identifying information of the individuals involved in any of these interactions. Furthermore, we don't have any of the content of the interactions that they were involved in, so whatever they said on their chat is not data that we have.
Tom, I'd like to bring you in here and ask, from your point of view, at what point do the positives outweigh the negatives? And the negatives may very well be, you know, a loss of data or perhaps, you know, infringements on personal privacy.
If you look at the web a few years ago, there was a lot of information but a limited amount of personal data. Now, almost every site that's created at its heart has something to do with, I will collect your personal data and I'll sell it to someone who wants it. And it can be dressed up in all sorts of ways, but if you, almost every pitch you hear, every initiative, somewhere in there, there's, when I get your data, I'll sell it to someone, they'll give me money. And people are usually quite explicit about that. Here's the deal. Here's a great new service, but you have to give me some data, and in return, I'll give you this service, and here's what I'm going to do with it. I think where you get into trouble is when you try and do that in an underhand way. You don't tell the consumer that this is actually what you're doing. So this sort of research that really gets people thinking about personal information and exploring what's going on is incredibly important.
One of the elements that's quite important in academic research, of course, is the ethic board. Professor Contractor, I was wondering, while you spoke about the protections that have been put into place for the consumers, what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with an international set of data. How have you, Professor Contractor, dealt with that issue when looking at the data?
We spent quite a lot of time involved in negotiating with Sony about what kind of data they were giving us and to what extent it was consistent with whatever agreements they had with their end users. In our case, the problem was even more complicated because it was a multi-university effort. So University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign had its lawyers negotiate with Sony a non-disclosure agreement and were very careful in determining what kinds of data sharing would be appropriate, as well as deciding what can be disclosed from this. And so that was one hurdle that needed to be crossed. Important that we did that to make sure that there were safeguards, recognizing that this is an international community, and so it's not one that is only beholden to U.S. laws in this case. We had anonymized data, but we also had data about the actual geographic location of each person. And so one of the things we were able to find, which is an important insight, was that people were much more likely to friend people within 50 kilometers of where they stayed. So in fact, they were 22.6 times more likely to communicate with someone close by than, say, somebody who's between 50 and 800 kilometers.
Professor Contractor, you should have seen the eyebrows go up around this table when you said that. And I'd just like to quickly ask Tom about this. Tom, we've spoken about, you know, the ethical protocols, that the hoops ultimately that had to be jumped through for this data and for some of these findings to come out. What types of ethical things do companies have to go through? Do they consider these types of things when they're collecting very similar types of data?
They do, but I think not enough. So for the most part, when companies think about collecting data, their focus is on how can we harvest it and how can we use it to market to people. And they tend to sort of do as much as they think they need to do in order not to get hit by regulators and so forth, but they don't really go beyond that boundary. And then on the other side of the coin, the fraudsters who are after this data know no boundaries. So to some extent, we need to allow the research to really get into this issue on a sort of international level, because to some extent the battle that we're fighting against identity thieves and fraudsters is an international one.
Tom, I think the dangers of posting, say, our personal contact information or our credit card information is quite easy for people to get their heads around, and they're perhaps slightly more careful with how they use that. As a kind of heavy Twitter user, though, I'm aware there's a lot more sort of soft information that could still potentially lay you open to some kind of vulnerability. Have you got any horror stories on exactly, what kind of mess you can get yourself into?
If a fraudster wants to get your password, one of the ways to do it is just to ring you up and say they're from IT and they're fixing your computer, and can you just tell them what your password is? And if they know something about you, it works even better. So there's a type of fraud that's going on at the moment where people go into social networking sites, set themselves up a persona, and then join a work group and say, I belong to this company and so forth, and just gradually build up a relationship and then start to ask, because they're now in the flow of information about that company, when they start to ask you things, you trust them. You trust people who sort of know a bit about you.
That's very sophisticated, kind of using the trust and the credibility that you build up through networks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for example, there was a case not long ago where fraud has moved into the dating sites, the online dating sites. So what the guys do is they get a photo of some really good looking guy or girl. They go onto the online dating site, set up a persona, build up a relationship, sometimes over a period of months, literally. And then it gets to the point where they say, you know, I'd love to come over and see you. Please can you send me the money for the ticket? And we once interviewed a guy who actually went to Heathrow Airport, stood there with his chocolates and flowers, waiting for this young lady to arrive. And when you looked at the chap and you looked at the picture of the young lady that he thought he was talking to, you knew straight away that this was never going to happen, but that's the way it was.
Tom, I'm interested from TechCrunch UK's perspective in the startup world, flipping the question around. What about things that where we actually might want to give our data away to because they help us do things? I mean, obviously, Last.fm is a good example of this. You know, it helped you kind of work out what kinds of other bands you liked if it scrubbed your MP3s. And also, there's a startup in Amsterdam called Wakupa, which will work out what applications you like if it works out what you're using. Can I subject myself to scientific analysis?
This world of personal information is changing, and what consumers need to realize is that their information is valuable and therefore they can use it as well. So I think so long as the contract, so long as the relationship is transparent, you know, I'm starting a new company and I say to you, I'm going to do this for you, but in return, give me some information. If you give me that information, here's exactly how I can use it, and here's the control that you have over it. That's very explicit. Then that's perfectly fine. When it's a bit murky, when people sort of feel, well, I'll tell them I'm doing this, but actually I'm doing that with their information, I think that's when you run into problems.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. You can read up more about this debate, obviously, at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now here's Jemima with the latest news.
As the Pirate Bay trial in Sweden hits its second week, the education minister in neighbouring Norway has spoken out in support of the site and said the music industry would do better to embrace file-sharing technologies. All previous technology advances have led to fears that the older format would die, he said. But TV did not kill radio, the web did not kill the book, and the download is not going to kill music. Tomb Raider creator Eidos is to be taken over by Square Enix, the Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy games firm, in a deal worth £84.3 million. The formal decision is due in early March, depending on shareholder reaction. Vodafone, the world's largest mobile phone group, is to cut hundreds of UK jobs as part of a £1 billion cost-cutting programme. Vodafone employs 10,000 people in the UK, but hasn't said where the bulk of the job cuts will hit. A US study shows that 59% of workers steal data when they leave a job, including financial reports, contact lists, and software tools. Ex-employees typically use the data to start their own business, get a job, or for revenge, but only 15% of firms check for data breaches when employees leave.
Thank you very much, Jemima. What's going on with Pirate Bay? It's not the users who are being attacked here. It's purely the facilitator. Has anything emerged since last week that has pointed perhaps to the users that might get them into the walking the plank, as it were?
There doesn't seem to be anything that Pirate Bay keeps which tracks users, which tracks who's doing what. It knows where the torrents are. But to be honest, if the film companies and the record companies want to go after people who are using BitTorrent to download copyrighted content, all they need to do is to join one of the torrents. And you can see everyone who's on them. Their IP address is in the clear. I mean, Bram Cohen, who's the inventor of the BitTorrent protocol, has said many times, you know, if you want to do something anonymously and secretly, don't do it on BitTorrent, because it's not anonymous, it's not secret at all.
And they're already seeding BitTorrent with fake files and fake movies.
I don't think the
studios and stuff aren't into doing it in viruses. But I think it's quite a smart thing to do, for example, to seed BitTorrent with low quality versions of files.
That's what they do, broken copies, ones that break off halfway through.
There are sometimes broken copies.
But that's an incredibly negative thing to do. I mean, this is the whole point about the Pirate Bay trial, is that regardless of the fact that they are using illegal content, these industry bodies have to be seen to be acting. But they're doing an enormous amount of reputation damage with young, very tech-savvy users who just trust this technology. They know it works, and it's a really good method of distribution.
But the thing is that they're taking stuff which they don't have any right to take.
Of course, this is
the objection, which is, you know, guys, if you wanted to pay for it, that'd be great, you know, and then find a way to BitTorrent around, that'd be terrific.
Well, wouldn't they be better to go in and buy Pirate Bay?
Like they did with Napster. That didn't go down so well ultimately with the users, okay. Did it?
The illegal stuff is going to shift somewhere. But, you know, what
it would
what
be
would
interesting,
that, what,
certainly,
what
to find a way.
What that would say to the outside world would be more positive and that they were embracing it.
Except you'd have to find a way to get people to pay for their trackers. And so you'd then get some sort of decentralized Pirate Bay set up, rather like you got Nutella following on from Napster.
This pod is absolutely on fire, Mike.
You're also going to get some savvy filmmakers and music artists who just work out, you know, how to actually make this work for themselves, right?
Well, there was even a newspaper the other day that said that it had released a newspaper through Pirate Bay, and, you know, that's obviously not going to work. But the fact that they're even trying that out is a great thing, I think. And
what they, but that was a Swedish know. That was a Swedish paper which was putting out a draft of its article to see what the people in the Pirate Bay, people who are getting stuff via the Pirate Bay, thought of the article, and they offered it some of their own views about what was right and what was wrong about the article, and so they took that in terms of the changes. Mm-hmm. It was sort of less a monetary model. And, you know, what I was trying to say earlier was that if the studios and so on put out low-res versions, you know, low-quality versions of films or music or whatever, and said, you know, here's where you can buy the high-quality one, you know, come on to the shop and get it, and if they could do that in a form which couldn't be ripped or whatever, I think they'd have a great model.
To be continued.
Indeed. I love the idea of Pirate Bay becoming the latest PR place like Second Life was. We've released something else on Pirate Bay.
We want to hear your ideas for business models on this, though. What where is the legitimate business model around Pirate Bay?
If you ask venture capitalists, what they say is things that this weird term called micro chunking, which is basically putting out content which has actually already got the monetization embedded in it. So you're halfway watching a film and there's an ad comes through. So you don't mind watching the low res version, you get the low res version for free, you see an advert, Bob's your uncle.
Well, another industry that is struggling with Pirate Bay is the games industry. And they have been trying to cope with piracy for a very, very long time. In fact, one of the British companies, Codemasters, has implemented a variety of technologies that, like you were saying, Jemima, the content just sort of fades out over time. And these are some of the ways that they've been trying to counteract piracy. However, in games industry news, you mentioned, Jemima, that Eidos, the British publisher that was owned by SCI, which was also a British publisher, has been purchased by Square Enix, the Japanese software giant.
Yes, not quite signed on the dotted line just yet, but that would mean that is it Britain's last? You can tell me, Alex. Britain's last games publisher.
One of Britain's last, I believe. Yeah. Codemasters is still British owned, but I can't actually remember. I don't have that data directly in my brain.
That's fine. We'll let you off.
Thank you very much. But yes, unfortunately, that does mean that the largest independent British publisher has gone down with the ship. Which is slightly distressing for the computer games industry in this country.
But isn't this sort of like, you know, the Times being owned by Rupert Murdoch and, you know, a foreign corporation? You still get the games, you still got the newspaper, in effect, you know, written inside the UK. It's just that the profits, such as they might be, go to a different country.
But the question there is about the editorial control. If we're looking at who is publishing the content, publishers in the games industry have a profound amount of impact on the actual content of the games. And that's where things start to get a little bit terrifying for the creative innovation of the industry in this country. Anyway, you can keep up with these stories and check out the latest all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, before I forget, next week we are having our startup surgery. And Jemima, can you tell us a little bit more about who we've got coming in?
Yeah, we have a legal wizard coming in who is an expert in the area of startup law. So those of you out there that are working in a small startup and you've got some burning issues around, I don't know, somebody make an investment in your firm or your use of data or perhaps the international terms of use on your site, refining all those areas of your business, email us, tech@guardian.co.uk, or you can tweet them to GuardianTW or post a comment on the blog, and we will assimilate all of those next week and hopefully resolve all your problems.
Last week, our man on the scene, Richard Ray, filled us in on the early news stories from the Mobile World Congress. This week, we've got our man with the backwards glance, Mike Butcher, editor of TechCrunch UK. And you were there, Mike. So what was the atmosphere like?
Well, the attendance this year was down from 55,000 last year to 50,000. If you can notice that, you're a better man than I. But certainly, what the feedback I got from people I was talking to there was that actually you got less tire kickers, you got real people doing real business, real deals. Well, it was a very corporate environment. Obviously, it's a real trade show, big, huge trade show. But yeah, generally, I think there's a lot of reality, as it were, the dawning on the mobile world.
What about the app scene? How does that feel at the minute? Because certainly from the outside, it feels as if a lot of people are jumping on the iPhone bandwagon, really, aren't they?
You have Samsung, Microsoft, Nokia, all launching application stores that will enable you to download these cute little, clever little applications straight to your phone. So a lot of the real action, as it were, was sort of out there amongst these applications developers who actually weren't really at the conference. So what you have is very large companies and lots of sort of small developers out there who really, I think, we're standing on the precipice of something really quite interesting over the next couple of years.
Well, I wanted to ask on the sort of British front, really, who was the in the contingent over there? I mean, what were the exciting sort of startups doing things in the mobile space?
Well, you had some more familiar names like Truphone, who have vast amounts of funding, Shouzu, Spinvox, but also some of the kind of smaller companies like Rumble, Flirtomatic, all out there sort of flying the flag for UK startups. And in fact, actually, there was a UK trade and industry lunch where we were addressed by a minister, Lord Davies.
UK Trade and Investment. I have to throw that in there
as
the sector champion.
Who did you have to defeat to become the champion?
I do not give up my secrets, but there were rocks involved.
We were addressed by a minister who said he was the listening minister and please email him with suggestions about UKTI and then promptly left.
We do get accused, I admit, quite fairly, that we talk about the iPhone quite a lot, and we've talked about Google's Android platform quite a lot, and we don't really talk about enough of the other handset manufacturers and what they're doing. I mean, were there any really sexy handsets that really caught your eye?
Well, there's some kind of weird things like the Modu, which is a tiny little phone which is supposed to be slipped into like an MP3 player or a bigger screen or something like that. And also the interesting development of all these PC makers finding that they're not actually making any money out of PCs anymore, so they might as well start making mobile phones. And so you had people like Acer coming out with a mobile phone. And also you got sort of Sony Ericsson coming out with this concept phone called the iDo, which will have a 12-megapixel camera, better than some actual cameras. So
better than actual eyes.
Better than your actual eyes, yes.
Games. You know, they've been talking about things that you can play on your phones. And in the Nokia N-Gage tried it, Vodafone tried it, a whole variety of people tried it. But ultimately, they all kind of fell by the wayside because the handsets or they weren't, you know, phones weren't integrated enough and this and that. Are we really going to see the convergence? Is this trend really obvious on the show floor now?
Well, I think actually it's funny you should mention that, but there was an emphasis on things like films, short films on mobile. Kevin Spacey made an appearance to talk about the short film festival. But I mean, if you look at something like the Toshiba TG01, which has a 1 gigahertz chip, that can actually run sort of stuff much faster, and I think it really comes down to processing power for games. So, you know, real handheld games consoles are really built to run games because they have to, you know, do it quickly. But if you're trying to run your phone and suddenly it's running out of juice because you've been playing a game for half an hour, then that's not so useful as a mobile phone.
What kind of presence was there from non-telephonic apparatus at Mobile World Congress? Do you like that? I'm a wordsmith.
Nice.
I'm a wordsmith.
Yes. Well, I mean, surprisingly, not that much. I mean, we ran an event for TechCrunch on the last day just to talk about all this stuff with some startups. And one of the things that came up is, and hold on a second, we're all talking about mobile phones. Where's all this kind of the mythical Apple tablet and these kinds of cool touch interfaces which are coming out now? WiMAX, apparently, you know, WiMAX and the next generation of mobile phones, what they call long-term evolution, 4G or whatever, these new sort of wireless devices may have different kinds of interfaces that we're used to.
And how about the cloud as well? Because I can see why, if you want to take really good photos on your phone, then obviously it has to have a lot of megabuckets, as we like to call them. But surely we're going to see phones with smaller and smaller memories and more stuff sort of living out in the ether.
Well, yes and no. I mean, with the 12 megapixel phone from Sony Ericsson due out hopefully later this year or maybe next year, how on earth are you going to send an MMS message with a 12 megapixel phone? It'll take about 3 days to send. And that's really why we need this next generation of wireless networks to come through. But at Shouzu, who are a company, a British company there, which is what a lot of people use to upload to Flickr, what they're actually seeing is not so much people uploading videos and photos nearly as much as little tiny little status updates. So funnily enough, things like Twitter, Facebook, little sort of checking out what everyone's doing, telling everyone what you're doing, are really, like, they're seeing huge adoption on that sort of thing on Shouzu. So it's you know, it's very interesting times we live in.
Well, that will be very interesting to see over the next 12 months. And we will definitely have you in before those 12 months are over, Mike. So, but we expect to hear, again, Backwards Glance, Mobile World Congress 2010.
You got it.
Yeah, you're booked. Consider yourself booked. All of our MWC coverage can be seen at guardian.co.uk/technology. And I imagine there's plenty over on TechCrunch UK, isn't there, Mike?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, I think you've been hearing our opinions enough for the past 20 minutes. Charles, what about the opinions of the people on the technology blog?
Well, over on the tech blog, the most commented story this week was about Apple and how its sales in the US have been falling, according to NPD Group, which reckon its retail sales had fallen. This doesn't take into account, of course, online sales or sales through Apple shops, but it's an interesting indicator. It's something that people had been perhaps forecasting. And it turned into a huge long thread, and there was lots of back and forth and so on. And eventually Graham Cox popped up, and after a fair bit of back and forth between various people, he said, who had been saying, "Well, don't you think that makes you look better?" "Well, I think that makes you look better." And he popped up and said, "You know what does look desperately sad? People who bother to get into tit-for-tat arguments in the comments section of a blog."
Ooh, handbags. That never happens on blogs, does it?
I've never seen that ever before.
Tit for tat and all that kind of stuff. Well, over on the games blog, I reported on some academic research that argued that violence is not what actually makes computer games players continue to play games. It's actually the sense of control and competence. That's what motivates people to play games. So it can be, you know, basically what they did, they did survey research and then they did experimental research. And they set up people on the low violence setting of a game like Halo. This was actually quite interesting. They used real games. They used games that had potential violence in them. So they had the low violence.
This is the Halo version with feather dusters, is it?
This is the one with the BFG. So they had people on the low violence setting and then people on the high violence setting. And both parties responded almost in exactly the same way. In fact, it was the people who were on the low violence setting who found that they enjoyed the game even more. Anyway.
Bejeweled.
Yeah, a high violence setting on the shield.
I can't. Kill him.
It just depends on how badly you're doing at any one point. You are violent against the computer.
The violent version of Tetris.
Well, there, don't laugh. There are. Anyway, this is after a great debate. Doc R says that, isn't that what they say about psychopaths and criminals as well, though? And there, of course, he was talking about the issues of control and competence. Jemima, let's go over to you and stop vilifying the people that I love.
We did a big chunk in the media print section and on PDA about asking people what they use Twitter for. So a huge amount of responses, obviously tweeted in. Had about 250 replies. Most people is kind of consensus. It was sharing ideas, sharing news, and procrastinating at work, really, among other things. But it was a very interesting reply from Daryl Parker, who said, "I write mostly science fiction within the limits of Twitter's 140 characters. You can read the effort at @twirledview, twirledview, if you want to check it out." I did check it out. Here's a couple, just as a taster. "He sat silently on the edge of the launch bay and stared out the airlock into the depths of space. He allowed himself to grieve and he wept." There's another one. "Last to sign, he had led the 300 Planet Council to unanimity on the Galactic Treaty. He had to go. That tuna salad he had for lunch was bad."
So I just love it.
It's not a haiku.
I'm sure the one of his I've come across, I think it's his, is "Time travel works, but only into the past. I shivered as I read my handwriting."
Very good.
I love it. It's creative. And, you know, why the hell not do that? Good on him.
I really actually like the person who tweets as the red swing line stapler from Office Space. Very funny. Yes, please.
Have you ever tried alternative reality Twittering, where you sort of say, I'm currently flying over London in a helicopter, or that kind of thing? That's quite fun.
I think they just call that lying, don't you?
Oh, yeah, sure. Can.
You can spin it any way you like it, Jemima. Any way you like it. Well, you can get in touch any old way. Don't forget to keep an eye out for our tweets on Monday afternoons when we reach out to the Massive for suggestions and your input for what we're going to be talking about next week. Looking into my crystal ball, as I mentioned before, we are going to be doing the startup surgery. So do send in questions you have for our special guest. You can either do that via Twitter, which is GuardianTW, or you can send all of your questions to tech@guardian.co.uk. He will answer them and you will be wiser.
In this week's Guardian Tech section, high fiber. If you want to create a fiber optic network, bad news. The government will tax you heavily on it. Find out about one Soho company's experience of rules which charge BT much cheaper rates than anyone else. We investigate Build Your Dream, which claims it'll be a Chinese electric car to compete with the Prius and other marques. In Free Our Data, we ask, if half of the Royal Mail is sold off, who gets ownership of the postcode address file, which has numerous applications? At the moment, no one seems to know. We look at endlessly playable games, LED lighting, and there's more on poker robots. It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's it from us for this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'd like to thank our guests, Tom Alube from Garlic, Noshia Contractor from Northwestern, Mike, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Absolutely brilliant to have you in. And like I said, you will definitely be in before 2010, but do make sure that you have something prepared.
Thank God, I can't wait.
And Charles, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Jemima?
It was a treat.
Oh, fabulous. And Scott over there, wave at Scott. Thank you very much, Scott. And again, thank you very much for listening. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.